This is Audible.
Out of the Dust by Karen Hess. Winter, 1934. Beginning, August 1920. As summer wheat came ripe, so did I, born at home on the kitchen floor. Ma crouched, barefoot, bare-bottomed over the swept boards, because that's where Daddy said it'd be best. I came too fast for the doctor, bawlin' as soon as Daddy wiped his hand around inside my mouth. To hear Ma tell it, I hollered myself red the day I was born. Red's the color I've stayed ever since. Daddy named me Billy Joe. He wanted a boy. Instead, he got a long-legged girl with a wide mouth and cheekbones like bicycle handles. He got a red-headed, freckle-faced, narrow-hipped girl with a fondness for apples and a hunger for playing fierce piano. From the earliest I can remember, I've been restless in this little panhandle shack we call home, always getting in Ma's way with my pointy elbows, my fidgety legs. By the summer I turned 9, Daddy had given up about having a boy. He tried making me do. I look just like him. I can handle myself most everywhere he puts me, even on the tractor, though I don't like that much. Ma tried having other babies. It never seemed to go right except with me. But this morning, Ma led on as how she's expecting again. Other than the three of us, there's not much family to speak of. Daddy, the only boy Kelby left since Grandpa died from a cancer that ate up the most of his skin. And Aunt Ellis, almost 14 years older than Daddy, and living in Lubbock, away south of here and a whole world apart to hear Daddy tell it. And Ma, with only great-uncle Floyd, old as ancient Indian bones and mean as a rattler, rotting away in that room down in Dallas. I'll be nearly 14, just like Aunt Ellis was when Daddy was born by the time this baby comes. Wonder if Daddy'll get his boy this time. January, 1934. Rabbit Battles. Mr. Noble and Mr. Romney have a bet going as to who can kill the most rabbits. It all started at the rabbit drive last Monday over to Sturgis when Mr. Noble got himself worked up about the damage done to his crop by jacks. Mr. Romney swore he'd had more rabbit trouble than anyone in Cimarron County. They pledged revenge on the rabbit population, wagering who could kill more. They ought to just shut up, betting on how many rabbits they can kill. Honestly, grown men clubbing bunnies to death makes me sick to my stomach. I know rabbits eat what they shouldn't, especially this time of year when they could hop halfway to Liberal and still not find food. But Miss Freeland says, if we keep plowing under the stuff they ought to be eating, what are they supposed to do? Mr. Noble and Mr. Romney came home from Sturgis Monday with 20 rabbits apiece, a tie. It should have stopped there, but Mr. Romney wasn't satisfied. He said, Noble cheated. He brought in rabbits somebody else killed. And so the contest goes on. Those men, they used to be best friends. Now they can't be civil with each other. They scowl as they pass on the street. I'm scowling too, but scowling won't bring the rabbits back. They're all skinned and cooked and eaten by now. At least they didn't end up in Romney and Noble's cook pots. They went to families that needed the meat. January, 1934. Losing Livy. Livy Killian moved away. I didn't want her to go. We'd been friends since first grade. The farewell party was Thursday night at the old rock schoolhouse. Livy had something to tease each of us about, like Ray sleeping through reading class, and Hillary, who on her speed writing test put an even ton of children instead of an even 10. Livy said goodbye to each of us separately. She gave me a picture she'd made of me sitting in front of a piano, wearing my straw hat, an apple halfway to my mouth. I handed Livy the memory book we'd all filled with our different slants. I couldn't get the muscles in my throat relaxed enough to tell her how much I'd miss her. Livy helped clean up her own party, wiping spilled lemonade, gathering sandwich crusts, sweeping cookie crumbs from the floor, while the rest of us went home to study for semester reviews. Now, Livy's gone west, out of the dust on her way to California, where the wind takes a rest sometimes. And I'm wondering what kind of friend I am, wanting my feet on that road to another place instead of Livy's. January, 1934. Me and Mad Dog. Arlie Wonderdale, who teaches music once a week at our school, though Ma says he's no teacher at all, just a local song plugger. Arlie Wonderdale asked if I'd like to play a piano solo at the Palace Theater on Wednesday night. I grinned, pleased to be asked, and said, "That'd be all right." I didn't know if Ma would let me. She's an old mule on the subject of my schooling. She says, "You stay home on weeknights, Billy Joe." And mostly that's what I do. But Arlie Wonderdale said, "The management asked me to bring them talent, Billy Joe, and I thought of you." Even before Mad Dog Craddock, I wondered. "You and Mad Dog," Arlie Wonderdale said. Darn that blue-eyed boy with his fine face and his smooth voice. Twice as good as a plowboy has any right to be. I suspected Mad Dog had come first to Arlie Wonderdale's mind, but I didn't get too riled. Not so riled I couldn't say yes. January, 1934. Permission to play. Sometimes, when Ma is busy in the kitchen or scrubbing or doing wash, I can ask her something in such a way I annoy her just enough to get an answer, but not so much I get a no. That's a way I've found of gaining what I want, by catching Ma off guard, especially when I'm after permission to play piano. Right out asking her is no good. She always gets testy about me playing, even though she's the one who truly taught me. Anyway, this time, I caught her in the slow stirring of biscuits, her mind on other things. Maybe the baby growing inside her, I don't know. But anyhow, she was distracted enough, I was determined enough. This time I got just what I wanted. Permission to play at the palace. January, 1934. On stage. When I point my fingers at the keys, the music springs straight out of me. Right hand, playing notes sharp as tongues, telling stories while the smooth, buttery rhythms back me up on the left. Folks sway in the palace aisles, grinning and stomping and out of breath. And the rest, eyes shining, fingers snapping, feet tapping. It's the best I've ever felt, playing hot piano, sizzling with Mad Dog, swinging with the Black Mesa boys, or on my own, crazy, pestering the keys. That is heaven. How supremely heaven playing piano can be. January, 1934. Birthday for FDR. I played so well on Wednesday night, Arlie put his arm across my shoulder and asked me to come and perform at the president's birthday ball. Ma can't say no to this one. It's for President Roosevelt. Not that Mr. Roosevelt will actually be there, but the money collected at the ball, along with balls all over the country, will go in the president's name to the Warm Springs Foundation, where Mr. Roosevelt stayed once when he was sick. Someday, I plan to play for President Franklin Delano Roosevelt himself. Maybe I'll go all the way to the White House in Washington, D.C. In the meantime, it's pretty nice Arlie asking me to play twice for Joyce City. January, 1934. Not too much to ask. We haven't had a good crop in 3 years, not since the bounty of 31. And we're all whittled down to the bone these days, even Ma with her new round belly. But still, when the committee came asking, Ma donated 3 jars of applesauce and some cured pork, and a feed sack nighty she'd sewn for our coming baby. February, 1934. Mr. Hardley's Money Handling. It was Daddy's birthday, and Ma decided to bake him a cake. There wasn't money enough for anything like a real present. Ma sent me to fetch the extras with 50 cents she'd been hiding away. "Don't go to Joy City, Billy," she said. "You can get what we need down Hardley's store." I slipped the coins into my sweater pocket, the pocket without the hole, thinking about how many sheets of new music 50 cents would buy. Mr. Hardley glared when the Wonder Bread door banged shut behind me. He squinted as I creaked across the wooden floor. Mr. Hardley was in the habit of charging too much for his stale food, and he made bad change when he thought he could get away with it. I squinted back at him as I gave him Ma's order. Mr. Hardley's been worse than normal since his attic filled with dust and collapsed under the weight. He hired folks for the repairs and argued over every nail and every little minute. The whole place took shoveling for days before he could open again, and some stock was so bad it had to be thrown away. The stove clanked in the corner as Mr. Hardley filled Ma's order. I could smell apples, ground coffee, and peppermint. I sorted through the patterns on the feed bags, sneezed dust, blew my nose. When Mr. Hardley finished sacking my things, I paid the bill, and tucking the list in my pocket along with the change, hurried home so Ma could bake the cake before Daddy came in. But after Ma emptied the sack, setting each packet out on the oilcloth, she counted her change, and I remembered with a sinking feeling that I hadn't kept an eye on Mr. Hardley's money handling, and Mr. Hardley had cheated again. Only this time, he cheated himself, giving us 4 cents extra. So while Ma mixed a cake, I walked back to Mr. Hardley's store, back through the dust, back through the Wonder Bread door, and thinking about the second-hand music in a moldy box at the shop in Joy City, music I could have for 2 cents a sheet. I placed Mr. Hardley's overpayment on the counter and turned to head back home. Mr. Hardley cleared his throat, and I wondered for a moment if he'd call me back to offer a piece of peppermint or pick me out an apple from the crate. But he didn't, and that's okay. Ma would have thrown a fit if I'd taken a gift from him. February, 1934. 50 miles south of home. In Amarillo, wind blew plate glass windows in, tore electric signs down, ripped wheat straight out of the ground. February, 1934. Rules of dining. Ma has rules for setting the table. I place plates upside down, glasses bottom side up, napkins folded over forks, knives, and spoons. When dinner is ready, we sit down together, and Ma says, "Now." We shake out our napkins, spread them on our laps, and flip over our glasses and plates, exposing neat circles, round comments on what life would be without dust. Daddy says, "The potatoes are peppered plenty tonight, Polly," and "Chocolate milk for dinner, aren't we in, Clover?" When really, all our pepper and chocolate, it's nothing but dust. I heard word from Livy Killian. The Killians can't find work, can't get food. Livy's brother Reuben, 15 last summer, took off, thinking to make it on his own. I hope he's okay. With a baby growing inside Ma, it scares me thinking, where would we be without somewhere to live, without some work to do, without something to eat? At least we've got milk, even if we have to chew it. February, 1934. Breaking drought. After 70 days of wind and sun, of wind and clouds, of wind and sand, after 70 days of wind and dust, a little rain came. February, 1934. Dazzled. In the kitchen, she is my Ma. In the barn and the field, she is my Daddy's wife. But in the parlor, Ma is something different. She isn't much to look at, so long and skinny. Her teeth poor, her dark hair always needing a wash. But from the time I was 4, I remember being dazzled by her whenever she played the piano. Daddy bought it, an old Kramer, his wedding gift to her. She came to this house and found gaps in the walls, a rusty bed, no running water, and that piano, gleaming in the corner. Daddy gets soft eyes standing behind her while she plays. I want someone to look that way at me. On my 5th birthday, Ma sat me down beside her and started me to reading music, started me to playing. I'm not half so good as Ma. She can pull Daddy into the parlor even after the last milking, when he's so beat he barely knows his own name, and all he wants is a mattress under his bones. You've got to be something to get his notice that time of day, but Ma can. I'm not half so good with my crazy playing as she is with her fine tunes and her fancy fingerwork. But I'm good enough for Arlie, I guess. March, 1934. Debts. Daddy is thinking of taking a loan from Mr. Roosevelt and his men to get some new wheat planted, where the winter crop has spindled out and died. Mr. Roosevelt promises Daddy won't have to pay a dime till the crop comes in.
Daddy says, I can turn the fields over, start again. It's sure to rain soon. Wheat's sure to grow.
Ma says, what if it doesn't? Daddy takes off his hat, roughs up his hair, puts the hat back on.
Course it'll rain, he says.
Ma says, Bay, it hasn't rained enough to grow wheat in 3 years. Daddy looks like a fight brewing. He takes that red face of his out to the barn to keep from feuding with my pregnant Ma. I ask Ma how, after all this time, Daddy still believes in rain.
Well, it rains enough, Ma says, now and again, to keep a person hoping.
But even if it didn't, your daddy would have to believe. It's coming on spring, and he's a farmer.
March, 1934.
Foul as maggoty stew. Arlie Wonderdale said the rehearsals for Sonny of Sunnyside shouldn't take me out of school more than twice next week. When I told Ma, she got angry about my missing school to play piano for some show. Me and Daddy, we're trying our best to please Ma for fear of what it might do to the baby if we don't. I don't know why she's so against my playing. She says that school is important, but I do all right in school. I know she doesn't like the kind of music I play, but sometimes I think she's just plain jealous when I'm at the piano and she's not. And maybe she's a little afraid of me going somewhere with the music she can't follow. Or of the music taking me so far away one day I'll never come home. Whatever the reason, she said I couldn't do it. Arlie had to get somebody to take my place. I do as she says. I go to school, and in the afternoons I come home, run through my chores, do my reading and my math work at the kitchen table, and all the while I glare at Ma's back with a scowl foul as maggoty stew.
March, 1934.
State tests. When I got home, I told Ma our school scored higher than the whole state on achievement tests, and I scored top of 8th grade. Ma nodded. I knew you could. That's all she said. She was proud, I could tell. But she didn't coo like Mad Dog's Ma, or go on like Mrs. Killian used to do. Daddy says, that's not your Ma's way. But I wish it was. I wish she'd give me a little more to hold on to than I knew you could. Instead, she makes me feel like she's just taking me in like I was so much flannel dry on the line.
March, 1934.
Fields of flashing light. I heard the wind rise and stumbled from my bed, down the stairs, out the front door into the yard. The night sky kept flashing. Lightning danced down on its spindly legs. I sensed it before I knew it was coming. I heard it, smelled it, tasted it. Dust. While Ma and Daddy slept, the dust came, tearing up fields where the winter wheat set for harvest in June stood helpless. I watched the plants, surviving after so much drought and so much wind. I watched them fry or flatten or blow away, like bits of cast-off rags. It wasn't until the dust turned toward the house like a fired locomotive, and I fled, barefoot and breathless, back inside. It wasn't until the dust hissed against the windows, until it ratcheted the roof, that Daddy woke. He ran into the storm, his overalls half-hooked over his union suit. Daddy, I called. You can't stop dust. Ma told me to cover the beds, push the scatter rugs against the doors, dampen the rags around the windows, wiping dust out of everything. She made coffee and biscuits, waiting for Daddy to come in. Sometime after 4, rubbing low on her back, Ma sank down into a chair at the kitchen table and covered her face. Daddy didn't come back for hours, not until the temperature dropped so low it brought snow. Ma and I sighed, grateful, staring out at the dirty flakes, but our relief didn't last. The wind snatched that snow right off the fields, leaving behind a sea of dust. Waves and waves and waves of dust rippling across our yard. Daddy came in. He sat across from Ma and blew his nose. Mud streamed out. He coughed and spit out mud. If he had cried, his tears would have been mud too, but he didn't cry, and neither did Ma.
March, 1934.
Spring, 1934. tested by dust. While we sat taking our 6 weeks test, the wind rose and the sand blew right through the cracks in the schoolhouse wall, right through the gaps around the window glass, and by the time the tests were done, each and every one of us was coughing pretty good, and we all needed a bath. I hope we get bonus points for testing in a dust storm. April, 1934. Banks. Ma says everything we lost when the banks closed because they didn't have enough cash to go around, all the money that's ours is coming back to us in full. Good. Now we have money for a doctor when the baby comes. April, 1934. Beetwheat. County Agent Dewey had some pretty bad news. One quarter of the wheat is lost, blown away or withered up. What remains is little more than a wisp of what it should be, and every day we have no rain, more wheat dies. County Agent Dewey says, soon there won't be enough wheat for seed to plant next fall. The piano is some comfort in all this. I go to it, and I forget the dust for hours, testing my long fingers on wild rhythms, but Ma slams around in the kitchen when I play, and after a while she sends me to the store. Joe de la Flora doesn't see me passing by. He rides his fences, dazed by dust. I wince at the sight of his rib-thin cattle, but he's not even seeing them. I look at Joe and know our future is drying up and blowing away with the dust. April, 1934. Give up on wheat. Ma says, try putting in a pond, Bayard. We can fill it off the windmill. We've got a good well. Daddy grumbles, the water'll seep back into the ground as fast as I can pump it, Pa. We'll dry up our well and then we'll have nothing. Plant some other things then, Ma says. Try cotton, sorghum. If we plant the fields in different crops, maybe some will do better than wheat. Daddy says, no, it has to be wheat. I've grown it before, I'll grow it again. But Ma says, can't you see what's happening, Bayard? The wheat's not meant to be here. And Daddy says, what about those apple trees of yours, Pa? You think they are? Nothing needs more to drink than those two, but you wouldn't hear of leveling your apples, would you? Ma is bitterin'. I can see it in her mouth. A pond would work, she says, soundin' crusty and stubborn. And Daddy says, look it, Paul, who's the farmer, you or me? Ma says, who pays the bills? No one right now, Daddy says. Ma starts to quakin', but she won't let Daddy see. Instead, she goes out to the chickens, and her anger simmerin' over like a pot in an empty kitchen boils itself down doing chores. April, 1934. What I don't know. My teacher, Miss Freeland, is singing at the Shrine along with famous opera stars from all around the country in a play called Madame Butterfly. I've never heard of that play. Most everyone's heard of Madame Butterfly, Mad Dog says. How does that singing plowboy know something I don't? And how much more is out there most everyone else has heard of except me? April, 1934. Apple Blossoms. Ma has been nursing these two trees for as long as I can remember. In spite of the dust, in spite of the drought, because of Ma's stubborn care, these trees are thick with blossoms, delicate and pinky white. My eyes can't get enough of the sight of them. I stand under the trees and let the petals fall into my hair, a blizzard of sweet-smelling flowers dropped from the boughs of the two placed there in the front yard by Ma before I was born, that she and they might bring forth fruit into our home together. May, 1934. World War. Daddy was just 17 when he fought in the Great War off in France. There's not much he's willing to say about those days, except about the poppies. He remembers the poppies, red on the graves of the dead. Daddy says that war tore France up worse than a tornado, worse than a dust storm. But no matter. The wild poppies bloomed in the trail of the fighting, brightening the French countryside. I wish I could see poppies growing out of this dust. May, 1934. apples. Ma's apple blossoms have turned to hard green balls. To eat them now, so tart, would turn my mouth inside out, would make my stomach groan. But in just a couple months, after the baby is born, those apples will be ready, and we'll make pies and sauce and pudding and dumplings and cake and cobbler, and have just plain apples to take to school and slice with my pocket knife and eat one juicy piece at a time until my mouth is clean and fresh and my breath is nothing but apple. June 1934. Dust and rain. On Sunday, winds came, bringing a red dust like prairie fire, hot and peppery, searing the inside of my nose, the whites of my eyes, roaring dust, turning the day from sunlight to midnight. And as the dust left, rain came. Rain that was no blessing. It came too hard, too fast, and washed the soil away, washed the wheat away with it. Now, little remains of Daddy's hard work, and the only choice he has is to give up or start all over again. At the Strong Ranch, they didn't get a single drop. So who fared better? Ma looks out the window at her apple trees. Hard green balls have dropped to the ground, but there are enough left. Enough for a small harvest if we lose no more. June, 1934. Harvest. The combines have started moving across the fields, bringing in wheat, whatever has managed to grow. Mr. Tuttle delivered the first load to town, selling it for 73 cents a bushel. Not bad. Mr. Chaffin, Mr. Haverstick, and Mr. French, they've delivered their harvest, too, dropping it at the Joyce City Grain Elevator. Daddy asked Mr. Haverstick how things looked, and Mr. Haverstick said he figures he took 8 bushels off a 20-bushel acre. If Daddy gets 5 bushels to his acre, it'll be a miracle. June, 1934. On the Road with Arlie. Here's the way I figure it. My place in the world is at the piano. I'm earning a little money playing thanks to Arlie Wonderdale. He and his Black Mesa boys have connections in Keys and Goodwell and Texoma, and every little crowd is grateful to hear a rag or two played on the piano by a long-legged red-haired girl, even when the piano has a few keys soured by dust. At first, Ma crossed her arms against her chest and stared me down, hard-jawed and sharp, and said I couldn't go. But the money helped convince her, and the compliment from Marley and his wife Vera that they'd surely bring my Ma along to play, too, if she wasn't so far gone with a baby coming. Ma said okay, but only for the summer, and only if she didn't hear me gripe how I was tired, or see me dragging my back end around, or have to call me twice upon a morning, or find my farm chores falling down, and only if Arlie's wife Vera kept an eye on me. Arlie says my piano playing is good. I play a set of songs with the word baby in the title, like My Baby Just Cares for Me and Walking My Baby Back Home. I pick those songs on purpose for Ma, and the folks that come to hear Arlie's band, they like them fine. Arlie pays in dimes. Ma's putting my earnings away, I don't know where, saving it to send me to school in a few years. The money doesn't matter much to me. I'd play for nothing. When I'm with Arlie's boys, we forget the dust. We are flying down the road in Arlie's car, singing, laying our voices on top of the beat Miller Rice plays on the back of Arlie's seat. And sometimes, Vera up front chirps crazy notes with no words, and the sound she makes seem just about amazing. It's being part of all that, being part of Arlie's crowd I like so much, being on the road, being somewhere new and interesting. We have a fine time. And they let me play piano, too. June, 1934. Summer, 1934. Hope in a drizzle. Quarter inch of rain is nothing to complain about. It'll help the plants above ground and start the new seeds growing. That quarter inch of rain did wonders for Ma, too, who is ripe as a melon these days. She has nothing to say to anyone anymore, except how she aches for rain. At breakfast, at dinner, all day, all night she aches for rain. Today, she stood out in the drizzle, hidden from the road and from Daddy, and she thought from me, but I could see her from the barn. She was bare as a pear, raindrops sliding down her skin, leaving traces of mud on her face and her long back, trickling dark and light paths, slow tracks of wet dust down the bulge of her belly. My dazzling maw, round and ripe and striped like a melon. July 1934. Dion Quintuplets. While the dust blew down our road against our house, across our fields, up in Canada, a lady named Elzire Dion gave birth to 5 baby girls all at once. I looked at Ma, so pregnant with 1 baby. "Can you imagine 5?" I said. Ma lowered herself into a chair, tears dropping on her tight-stretched belly. She wept just to think of it. July 1934. Wild Boy of the Road. A boy came by the house today. He asked for food. He couldn't pay anything, but Ma sat him down and gave him biscuits and milk. He offered to work for his meal. Ma sent him out to see Daddy. The boy and Daddy came back late in the afternoon. The boy walked 2 steps behind in Daddy's dust. He wasn't more than 16, thin as a fence rail. I wondered what Livy Killian's brother looked like now. I wondered about Livy herself. Daddy asked if the boy wanted a bath, a haircut, a change of clothes before he moved on. The boy nodded. I never heard him say more than, "Yes, sir," or "No, sir," or "Much obliged." We watched him walk away down the road in a pair of Daddy's mended overalls, his legs like willow limbs, his arms like reeds. Ma rested her hands on her heavy stomach. Daddy rested his chin on the top of my head. "His mother is worrying about him," Ma said. "His mother is wishing her boy would come home." Lots of mothers wishing that these days, while their sons walk to California where rain comes, and the color green doesn't seem like such a miracle, and hope rises daily like sap in a stem. And I think, someday, I'm going to walk there too, through New Mexico and Arizona and Nevada. Someday I'll leave behind the wind and the dust and walk my way west, and make myself to home in that distant place of green vines and promise. July 1934. The accident. I got burned bad. Daddy put a pail of kerosene next to the stove, and Ma, fixing breakfast, thinking the pail was filled with water, lifted it to make Daddy's coffee, poured it. But instead of making coffee, Ma made a rope of fire. It rose up from the stove to the pail, and the kerosene burst into flames. Ma ran across the kitchen, out the porch door, screaming for Daddy. I tore after her. Then, thinking of the burning pail left behind in the bone-dry kitchen, I flew back and grabbed it, throwing it out the door. I didn't know. I didn't know Ma was coming back. The flaming oil splashed onto her apron, and Ma, suddenly, Ma was a column of fire. I pushed her to the ground, desperate to save her, desperate to save the baby. I tried, beating out the flames with my hands. I did the best I could. But it was no good. Ma got burned bad. July 1934. Burns. At first I felt no pain, only heat. I thought I might be swallowed by the heat, like the witch in Hansel and Gretel, and nothing would be left of me. Someone brought Doc Rice. He tended Ma first, then came to me. The doctor cut away the skin on my hands. It hung in crested strips. He cut my skin away with scissors, then poked my hands with pins to see what I could feel. He bathed my burns in antiseptic. Only then the pain came. July 1934. Nightmare. I am awake now, still shaken from my dream. I was coming home through a howling dust storm. My lowered face was scrubbed raw by dirt and wind. Grit scratched my eyes. It crunched between my teeth. Sand chafed inside my clothes, against my skin. Dust crept inside my ears, up my nose, down my throat. I shuddered, nasty with dust. In the house, dust blew through the cracks in the walls. It covered the floorboards and heaped against the doors. It floated in the air, everywhere. I didn't care about anyone, anything, only the piano. I searched for it, found it under a mound of dust. I was angry at Ma for letting in the dust. I cleaned off the keys, but when I played, a tortured sound came from the piano like someone shrieking. I hit the keys with my fist, and the piano broke into 100 pieces. Daddy called to me. He asked me to bring water. Ma was thirsty. I brought up a pail of fire, and Ma drank it. She had given birth to a baby of flames. The baby burned at her side. I ran away, to the Eaton's farm. The house had been tractored out, tipped off its foundation. No one could live there. Everywhere I looked were dunes of rippled dust. The wind roared like fire. The door to the house hung open, and there was dust inside, several feet deep. And there was a piano. The bench was gone right through the floor. The piano leaned toward me. I stood and played. The relief I felt to hear the sound of music after the sound of the piano at home. I dragged the Eaton's piano through the dust to our house, but when I got it there, I couldn't play. I had swollen lumps for hands. They dripped a sickly pus. They swung stupidly from my wrists. They stung with pain. When I woke up, the part about my hands was real. July, 1934. A tent of pain. Daddy has made a tent out of the sheet over Ma so nothing will touch her skin. What skin she has left. I can't look at her. I can't recognize her. She smells like scorched meat. Her body grown in there. It looks nothing like my Ma. It doesn't even have a face. Daddy brings her water and drips it inside the slit of her mouth by squeezing a cloth. She can't open her eyes. She cries out when the baby moves inside her. Otherwise, she moans day and night. I wish the dust would plug my ears so I couldn't hear her. July, 1934. Drinking. Daddy found the money Ma kept squirreled in the kitchen under the threshold. It wasn't very much, but it was enough for him to get good and drunk. He went out last night. While Ma moaned and begged for water, he drank up the emergency money until it was gone. I tried to help her. I couldn't aim the dripping cloth into her mouth. I couldn't squeeze. It hurt the blisters on my hands to try. I only made it worse for Ma. She cried for the pain of the water running into her sores. She cried for the water that would not soothe her throat and quench her thirst. And the whole time my father was in Guymon, drinking. July, 1934. Devoured. Doc sent me outside to get water. The day was so hot, the house was so hot. As I came out the door, I saw the cloud descending. It whirred like 1,000 engines. It shifted shape as it came, settling first over Daddy's wheat. Grasshoppers eating tassels, leaves, stalks. Then coming closer to the house, eating Ma's garden, the fence posts, the laundry on the line, and then the grasshoppers came right over me, descending on Ma's apple trees. I climbed into the trees, opening scabs on my tender hands, grasshoppers clinging to me. I tried beating them away, but the grasshoppers ate every leaf. They ate every piece of fruit. Nothing left but a couple apple cores hanging from Ma's trees. I couldn't tell her, couldn't bring myself to say her apples were gone. I never had a chance. Ma died that day, giving birth to my brother. August, 1934. Blame. My father's sister came to fetch my brother, even as Ma's body cooled. She came to bring my brother back to Lubbock to raise as her own, but my brother died before Aunt Ellis got here. She wouldn't even hold his little body. She barely noticed me. As soon as she found my brother dead, she had a talk with my father. Then she turned around and headed back to Lubbock. The neighbor women came. They wrapped my baby brother in a blanket and placed him in Ma's bandaged arms. We buried them together on the rise Ma loved, the one she gazed at from the kitchen window, the one that looks out over the dried-up Beaver River. Reverend Bingham led the service. He talked about Ma, but what he said made no sense, and I could tell he didn't truly know her. He'd never even heard her play piano. He asked my father to name my baby brother. My father hunched over, said nothing. I spoke up in my father's silence. I told the Reverend my brother's name was Franklin, like our president. The women talked as they scrubbed death from our house. I stayed in my room silent on the iron bed, listening to their voices. Billy Joe threw the pail, they said. An accident, they said. Under their words, a finger pointed. They didn't talk about my father leaving kerosene by the stove. They didn't say a word about my father drinking himself into a stupor while Ma writhed, begging for water. They only said, Billy Joe threw the pail of kerosene. August, 1934. Birthday. I walked to town. I don't look back over my shoulder at the single grave holding Ma and my little brother. I am trying not to look back at anything. Dust rises with each step. There's a greasy smell to the air. On either side of the road are the carcasses of jackrabbits, small birds, field mice, stretching out into the distance. My father stares out across his land, empty but for a few withered stalks like the tufts on an old man's head. I don't know if he thinks more of Ma or the wheat that used to grow here. There's barely a blade of grass swaying in the stinging wind. There are only these lumps of flesh that once were hands long enough to span octaves, swinging at my sides. I come up quiet and sit behind Arlie Wonderdale's house where no one can see me, and lean my head back and close my eyes and listen to Arlie play. August, 1934. Roots. President Roosevelt tells us to plant trees. Trees will break the wind. He says trees will end the drought. The animals can take shelter there. Children can take shelter. Trees have roots, he says. They hold on to the land. That's good advice, but I'm not sure he understands the problem. Trees have never been at home here. They're just not meant to be here. Maybe none of us are meant to be here, only the prairie grass and the hawks. My father will stay no matter what. He's stubborn as sod. He and the land have a hold on each other. But what about me? August, 1934. The empty spaces. I don't know my father anymore. He sits across from me. He looks like my father. He chews his food like my father. He brushes his dusty hair back like my father. But he is a stranger. I am awkward with him and irritated, and I want to be alone, but I am terrified of being alone. We are both changing. We are shifting to fill in the empty spaces left by Ma. I keep my raw and stinging hands behind my back when he comes near, because he stares when he sees them. September, 1934. The hole. The heat from the cook stove hurts my burns, and the salt, the water, and the dust hurt too. I spend all my time in pain, and